Hi, this is Drew, and thanks for listening to our podcast. Hopefully, you've been enjoying our show for a while now, but if you're a brand new listener, then the next 50 seconds are not for you, so just go ahead and fast forward a bit. I just wanted to ask our longtime listeners to consider becoming patrons of The Drew Marshall Show, because by throwing us just a few bucks each month, you'll be helping what many tell us is the most brutally authentic spiritual show they've ever heard stay on the air. Look, as loyal podcast listeners, you've been getting the same programming our radio listeners have been hearing live Saturdays 1 to 5 for the last 16 years. Except you get to hear everything commercial-free, you smart consumer, you. Well, because of a brand new arrangement with our studio, our expenses have now gone through the roof. And to be brutally honest, we could use the help to cover those costs. So just before you go to bed tonight, maybe you could stop by our website and click on the giant click here to become a patron sign. And if a whole bunch of you were able to scrounge up like $4 per month, then individually your $4 would have just made a massive difference in helping us cover what it costs to bring you the Drew Marshall Show. Okay, that's it. Sorry to bug you. Now on with the show. I hope you have a good sleep tonight after you become a patron.
Some say John was a Baptist. Some say John was a Jew. But I say John was a preacher, cause my Bible says so too. I say roll, roll.
Man, what is this?
Roll, good roll.
Really? That's
yeah,
what it's
yeah.
Called?
It's 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, right.
At a funeral.
Oh, man. Something about the old spirituals that just grab you, right?
Yeah.
Listen, just want to let everyone know that you are listening to The Drew Marshall Show. It's time for our conversation with Carrie Ross, and she is the daughter of the BTK killer. And she's just written a book called A Serial Killer's Daughter, My Story of Hope, Love, and Overcoming. So here's the deal, right? Like, what is it like to learn that your normal, loving father is a serial killer? Well, in 2005, Carrie Ross heard a knock on the door of her apartment, and when she opened it, an FBI agent informed her that her father had been arrested for murdering 10 people, including 2 children.
Can't even imagine that.
No, and obviously that's why the rest of us are incredibly engrossed in Terry's story. And of course, her book, I've got it right here in my hand, A Serial Killer's Daughter. Carrie, last night was a big night for you, 2020. What's that feel like?
Yeah, that was crazy. So I've got 2 kids, they're 10 and 7. So the 7-year-old was, of course, asleep. But we set the 10-year-old to the bedroom and put with the iPad and headphones. We shut the door because we wanted to watch it live. And we said, honey, just like knock on the door and we'll stop the TV for a second. So, because like she knows, like, so she's known since 5 that grandpa's in prison, which I even talked about on TV last night, but mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to protect them the best we can. You know, we're trying to keep him away from the acronym and of course everything he did. So like my kids just know, like, you know, that he did a lot of really bad things. So, but we're trying to really keep them safe.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean,
we
that's
a knock a few times and, yep. You know, ran her snacks.
Yeah, that's a whole nother dynamic I didn't even think of. I mean, it's one thing for you and your brother and mom to, you know, kind of have this shadow hanging over you. But now what about the grandkids? And how do you talk to them about it? And when do you, I mean, because they're going to get to an age where they can Google, right?
Yeah. So in the book I wrote, A Serial Killer's Daughter, there's the conversation with my father-in-law when I was young, right after it happened. I said, I was crying and I was like, what do we do when we have kids? And he said, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we didn't want to just drop them on a bombshell. Like you said, we didn't want them Googling it when they get to middle school or something. Mm-hmm. So when my daughter was 5, she noticed that she only had 1 grandpa. So we just started slowly trying to figure out, like, at their age development, what she knew. So like, she didn't even know what prison was at 5. So we told her it was a really long time out, you know, and then there's of course that question, like, when does he get out? And then you're like, well, he never does. And her eyes get really big,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then like you try to figure out what can they handle. So later on, then you're like, well, what's the worst thing a person could do? And they're like, you know, she's thinking of like the black and white stripes, like clothed burglar, you know, from her cartoon.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're like, no, I can't tell you this yet. Oh, so last night was crazy, but mainly like just really surreal to see yourself on TV, and then you get really like self-conscious, you know, because you notice every little thing about yourself.
Yep.
That was my first time on camera. So. Yeah.
What about, you know, now that the book is out and you've been on 2020, I mean, along with this kind of public notoriety come the whack jobs, right? Come the serial killer fan club stuff that's even out there. I mean, how are you protecting yourself from all of that? Or are you? And have you had any interactions with those who are part of that whole society?
I mean, you got to remember, we've been living this life for 14 years. So, you know, we're getting a lot of like public, like, you know, I'm personally getting a lot of public attention right now because of my book and because of becoming public in the news. Mm-hmm. But my husband and I have been walking this every day for 14 years.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, we're pretty used to it. And, like, the only whack job that writes us is my dad. So,
Wow.
We deal with a lot of online, and because I've had, that was one of the things, like, there was a really big internal struggle, like, do you even go on Facebook? Because thankfully we didn't really have social media in 05. You know, when do you go on? Do you share pictures with the kids? That's something I wrote about and struggled with, you know? And then when I knew I wanted to write, you know, I would like sort of ask people, like my publicity team, do I have to go on Facebook publicly? I was whining about it. And they're like, yeah, if you're going to sell a book, you're going to have to become public, mm-hmm. you know? And so the problem is, like, I mean, it's great because you've got like 95% of people that are supportive, and you know, there's thousands of encouraging messages that were rolling in like last night. But then you always get those few people that, you know, feel like they need to victim shame or fat shame or point out your makeup or your hair. Or then of course you get the creepers, like, you know, like somebody commented that now I drugged my kids into this mess and like I'm an awful person. And I mean, I even had comments last week that like this guy said he would like to throw my family into a wood chipper because, you know, I'm related to my dad.
Wow.
So, yeah. So with these guys, like I screenshot, I ban, I block, and I save it because, you know, I happen to know like a few detectives, just a few, you know, so.
Yeah, just a few. Yeah, geez.
Yeah. I mean, and then there's that element, I don't know if you know of, like, murder museums here in America, like where they collect artifacts of these guys, like my dad. Some of them are online, but then there's actual museums of like letters from these guys or hair, or, you know, I mean, the list could get really gross.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Like, these guys are online selling stuff of my dad. One even has, like, his profile pic is a picture of my dad, you know, and then they're over here on Instagram, like, following me or trying to talk to me, and, you know, I'm trying to figure out how do I, like, block these people.
Yeah. Is it true that your dad said to you, if you don't write or communicate with me more, I'm going to give somebody else my dead body?
Yes. So, man, you guys are good. In 2015, he didn't, so he read that I came out public and I did a large piece with Wichita Eagle from Kansas, my hometown. So he gets that paper and he read it, and it did like move him emotionally. But then like a few months later, he started writing, and like, he doesn't have anything left. Like, he has nothing left in prison to hold over anybody. So he started writing my mom and me, saying like that if we didn't start writing him more, you know, or communicate with him more, he would not let us have his ashes, that he would give his body to somebody else and let them bury him and give him a, you know, a cemetery marker, because we didn't want him to have a cemetery marker. And so we've told him since like 05, like 1,000 times in letters, you know, when you die, you get cremated, we'll bury, you know, we'll scatter your ashes in our Flint Hills, which are like rolling green hills in Kansas. And that was the agreement. But, you know, something in him, that narcissism in him, he just can't, like, just let things be.
No.
And so that's really hard because I never knew that guy. So that's like I said, like the only crazy person writing me is because it is dad.
Is your dad? Yeah. Well, Terry, I mean, it's been 14 years since your dad confessed, and you and your mom and brother really avoided media for the most part. That's what I understood. But now you're sort of really, really out there with this book. And, of course, the 2020 stuff and everything comes along with this book. So why now, right? Somebody would say, well, if you've been quiet for 14 years, why now?
Well, I mean, you got to remember, like, we didn't talk for 10 years, my family. Like, we the media was treating us really terrible at the first, and the FBI told us not to talk to them because they said it can just make things worse with the investigation and for your family. And then we were being stalked by them. So we knew right away not to do anything with the media, and they almost became like our enemy.
Right.
Because we were even hiding from them the first week. So after my dad's sentencing and his trial and stuff in the summer of 05, like, I pretty much shut down on everything. I didn't talk to my dad, and I started praying for, like, a quiet, private life. I would pray it over and over, you know. And so in a lot of ways, that prayer was answered for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was, I mean, I was in therapy, and I was trying to get on with my life. I was in women's ministry. I was a mom. You end up internalizing all the stuff you've gone through, all this trauma you've gone through, emotional abuse I didn't know I had. You know, I had PTSD. I didn't know that until I got to therapy. So you internalize all this horrible stuff that's happened to you, and you just stick it inside you, and you try to just push it aside and say, I'm going to go on with my life. Hmm. But the problem is you don't talk to anybody other than, say, in therapy or your husband or a family or something. So you're here in Michigan, and you're pretty much alone, you and your husband, like, and nobody in Michigan knows who you are. So you realize, like, at some point, you're going to have to let some people in. So you start, you know, sharing, say, in small groups at church. And then, like, you realize it helps you to talk about it. And then you realize it helps other people, like, to tell them what you've been through, and that, you know, when someone's telling you that they, like, they're not going to be able to get through something, you want to point to them and say, hey, I got through that.
Yeah, yeah.
So then, like, I just kind of exploded to the media in my hometown paper in the fall of 14. And, you know, even though I didn't really go about it right, like, the thing went international, which was crazy. Then I realized all of a sudden, like, talking to, like, a journalist that was a crime writer that had lived through all of that, like, that was healing. You know, like, working with journalists, you know, forcing myself to walk into a newspaper, basically walking into, like, the lion's den and your Daniel, you know, that there was strength in that. It like, taught me to, like, be brave and not fear the media.
Well, okay, so
then I just, like, you know, I realized that there was strength in talking.
Sure,
so I started,
sure.
I wrote the book.
Good for you. Okay, so I want to skim over a couple of details here, because most people know, well, whoever knows about the BTK killer, you know about stuff. We don't need to bring it up here in this conversation, but just to succinctly summarize, your dad bound, tortured, and killed 10 people between 74 and 91, and then he resurfaced again in 05, announcing that he was preparing to kill again. And they kind of, correct me if I'm wrong, but did they not catch him because he had some kind of computer fingerprint disc thing that they were able to track down to the church that he was a part of? Is that right?
Yeah, everything says right. So in 2004, he started communicating, and he hadn't since 79, and they didn't even think he was alive. So then in 04, he contacted the police and went through this whole game with them. And then in early 05, he sent just a regular old, like, 3-inch hard disk like we used to use back then, and he wasn't very tech savvy, and he had used it at the public library and at their church. And so it actually registered, and then he had put his name Dennis on something else. So then when he sent his BTK thing, like, the computer guy was able to, like, somehow get into the disk and find out where it had been used and who had used it. Yeah. And so then that's how they caught him.
So there's a couple of things here that I want to get into. The first one is, you know, people hear this and they go, really? The guy was a church guy? And then some people hear that and they go, yep, there you go. You see? Like, church people are nuts, and just because you're part of a church or into the God stuff doesn't mean you're any better than the rest of us. As a matter of fact, sometimes it makes you worse. How do you respond to that?
I mean, just because you're going to church, you're not, doesn't necessarily mean you're Christian or you're religious. There's a definition of Christian meaning having a relationship with Christ. And my dad definitely does not fall under that before the arrest. I mean, I never really saw that. I mean, I saw a man that it was important that he put his nice suit on and polished up his shoes and then looked nice at church, and was important that he was acting correctly, you know, doing ushering and communion and standing up and sitting down to sing. You know, like, I never saw somebody that was that God was important to him, because as soon as you stepped out of church, like, we never talked about our faith. And when I got older and I was trying to talk about a sermon or something, I got yelled at in the car. Like, we're basically leaving church, and I'm a teenager, and he like yells at me, we don't talk about sex, religion, or politics. You know, so, I mean, we had like a family Bible that was important, but nobody ever opened the Bible in our house. So, I mean, it was just more about it was like, because it was ingrained in our family, like, every week you go to church. But that's just my dad. Like, my mom's faith is important to her. Like, it's like she does have a relationship with God. But my dad, I think, was just more because maybe he thought it gave him a good cover, or just because it's what you do, or because of my mom.
Yeah, well, man, I mean, speaking of good cover, can't believe, well, I guess anything's possible. I've lived long enough to know that given the right set of circumstances, anybody can do anything. But your dad would use his time volunteering with the scouts and hanging out with your brother as his alibi. Like, I don't know how many times he did it, but he would, sneak off during a overnight scout trip and kill someone, and then come back to the scout camp and be Mr. Scout Leader guy. Wow.
Yeah, he did it twice. He did it in 85 when I was 6 and my brother was 9 on a camp out, and he did it again when I was 12 and my brother was 15 with the Boy Scouts. And that one was actually in the winter. So we have something called Trapper Rendezvous, and they go, like, sleep in the snow and do all these man things in the snow, which I always thought was funny when I was a kid. But so that was January of 91. And I think the reason he did that was because both of those were near my home. Mrs. Hedge was murdered down the street from me in 85 by him. And Mrs. Davis was murdered a couple of miles away in 91. And he never claimed those as BTK. And the police didn't know those were BTKs even in 04. He didn't claim those. He claimed one from 86 that was farther from our home. Mm-hmm. So he did his MO or was different on those, because he didn't want them tracing him back, because he lived just down the street. So I think that's partly why he used that as an alibi, plus it just worked for him.
Wow.
But
wow.
Like, I actually turned in, the day he was arrested, they were giving me dates and they said 86. And I said, well, my neighbor lady, you know, I knew she had been taken from her house and they had found her strangled. And somehow I knew that at 6, so I told the FBI. And I also told him my dad was gone that night, that he was at a camp out. So I actually thought I was alibiing my dad, saying my dad was gone and at a camp out.
Wow.
But, like, I also realized that was one of those moments I realized that my dad possibly could have murdered my neighbor.
Yeah, yeah.
And I told the FBI, and so then they asked him about it, or he told them that he had committed that one too.
We're chatting with Carrie Rawson. She's the daughter of the BTK killer. She's author of this hot new book, A Serial Killer's Daughter: My Story of Hope, Love, and Overcoming. And Carrie, I don't know, I guess the first thing that I'm thinking about, well, let's just go to this. Did you ever watch any of the confession tapes? You know, all these murderers have confession tapes that are out there these days. And I don't know if this is weird to admit this or not, but I find the dynamics of those interview tapes, like, I think I'm some kind of pretend sociologist. I find it so fascinating to watch people lying when you know they're lying hindsight, and then you watch them lie and that sort of thing. But in your dad, and not even lying, but just even in the way they're talking about what they've done, is there remorse? Is there not remorse? What kind of callousness is there? Can you see narcissism? Maybe that's the other thing I really like to look for, is narcissism obvious? So anyway, that's my issue with all this stuff, or my weirdness. Have you ever watched your own dad's confession tapes?
So actually, I had seen, so we didn't have cable in 05, which was kind of a good thing, but it was hard because we would have to follow the news on the internet. So I had only ever seen photos of my dad there in confession with Landwehr and the other detectives in Wichita. I had not seen tape until last night. So that was that. What was difficult last night was I knew the story in and out, but I hadn't seen all the visuals of my dad's crime scenes or my dad get up. And I had not seen the confession tapes, or I hadn't seen all of the video was in the trial because I couldn't handle it back then.
Yeah.
So, like, I've done enough reading and research, and I like it didn't get to me too much. But yeah,
no, but not even the details of the crime, but just to see the confession tapes where your dad, you know, the police or the FBI, whoever was interrogating him, to see his response and how he owned stuff. Is that something you never want to see then?
No, I mean, I've read all the transcripts, so I could watch it. And
okay.
But you can see, like, that was the first time, like, he was letting down those masks of being, like, a church leader and a Boy Scout leader and a dad and Dennis Rader. And that's when he, to me, becomes BTK.
Got it.
Even though, of course, like, that's when you see those masks drop and you see the narcissism and the ego and the one of the attention and the insanity, and you see it again in the letters, but you can see it physically in him. Like Darian and I, my husband Darian and I said last night, it didn't even really look like my dad, or when he's talking in court, and he doesn't even sound the same, and he moves his body different. It's almost like it's a different personality, even though I know that's not true, because his body changes. It's all tight, and he talks fast, his arms wave, and he wasn't like that at all. And then, you know, I even had read like these like horrible things, like he really got into talking about a murder, and the police actually made him stop because they didn't want him like being that excited about it.
Right.
But you see him the first three or four hours, he's trying to dodge, but like everybody knows he's BTK in that room, and he knows, so he's just kind of lamely trying to like dodge, and he's like, well, you have DNA on me, or what do you have, or what do you got on this guy?
Oh, he's just playing like, games.
Yeah, he's totally playing games. And, you know, Ken Landwehr is, like, my hero, the main detective, and he kept pushing him. And he told him, he said, you know, you either tell us who you are and where your stuff is, like, in the house, or we're going to go tear it up. And he said, I don't think you want that for your wife and kids. And that was one of the things that finally got my dad to confess. And then they were very, very, very polite and only took what they did. And you wouldn't have been even able to tell they had been in our home.
You know, in these sorts of scenarios, everybody in the world wants to know why, right? When it comes to someone doing something evil, they want to know why. Did your dad ever actually explain why, or did he just stay with this factor X thing?
I mean, that is, he doesn't know why. Like, these guys don't know why. I mean, you can look at Bundy, Kemper, the ones that will talk about it. They don't even really know why. They can point to things that happened in their childhood, or they can point to things they were doing early on. And that stuff can sort of combine into, say, their factor X.
Mm-hmm.
My dad is basically just saying, I got this one awful, evil thing inside my head. You know, my brain's not right. It's disconnected. Like, if you think about a psychopath, they don't necessarily have a conscience, or, you know, that feeling of guilt or shame or remorse, or that thing that stopped us from committing crimes. He doesn't have that, or it doesn't connect.
Has anybody tried to kind of put it on the military experience he had? Was there any PTSD there? Or
No. He wasn't in non. He's full of, okay. The thing with my dad, you got to remember, is he's a narcissistic psychopath. You can't believe anything he says.
Right.
And then he's going to try to dodge any sort of responsibility. No, he didn't want to get drafted because he was only in college a little bit. And my grandpa, who had been a Marine in World War II and had served in the Pacific, like, knew his sons were going to end up getting drafted. And he didn't want him getting drafted. So he told them, you either go enlist or you're going to get drafted. So my grandpa encouraged, like, he had my dad and two brothers all enlisted. And so my dad was in the Air Force. And so he served in like Turkey and Japan and Korea as a communications person. So he didn't see any conflict. Like, he basically had like a 4-year vacation on the Air Force compared to what the guys had in NOT.
Yeah.
He came back with souvenirs and talked about it like it was a vacation.
Right.
But my uncle, his brothers, they both saw action in NOT, and of course they never talked about it. So growing up, I definitely knew the difference between someone that had served versus someone like my dad. Carrie, so no, the military didn't do anything.
No, nothing. Okay, got it, got it. Carrie, let's, you know, I'm always intrigued as to what impact traumatic stuff has on someone's spiritual life. So you're a Jesus girl, right? You're a Christian girl, and that's a big part of your book, and you talk a lot about it. So succinctly, and I'm just looking at the clock. We're running out of time here. This is driving me nuts. There's so many questions I have for you. Have you always been a Jesus girl? Did it just become more real later? How did the God stuff, like, what impact did your spiritual life have on you recovering from this unbelievable news that your dad murdered 10 people, two of them kids, he's the BTK killer? Like, did God reach down and touch you in some kind of miraculous way? Have you been healed? I say that with a bit of facetiousness in my voice, so set me straight if I'm wrong about this. What's going on with you spiritually?
So, like you were talking about with church, I grew up Lutheran, so I had the foundation, but it didn't mean a lot to me. Then I walked away from God. I didn't believe in him in my teenage years. Mm-hmm. Then I personally found him actually in the Grand Canyon. I was with my dad, and I started praying because we got in a lot of trouble in 97. So I started finding God for the first time, the first time I probably had prayed or tried to talk to him. But then in college, I actually became a Christian with the foundation of a group called Campus Crusade for Christ. So I had that strong foundation by the time of the arrest. And so, like, if I hadn't had the foundation of knowing God and knowing some scripture and believing in it, I wouldn't still be alive. So, like, the first night I prayed to God, I said, or just cried out, really, more like, I don't know how I'm going to get through the night. And so Psalm 23 came to me. And in these moments early on, like, a piece of scripture would get to me, and I would be able to be strong enough to get on the plane, you know, in front of a video of my dad. So we got back to church here and built a community, and then that's the safe place I started sharing my story. So, like, my faith is what is one of the tenets that keeps me alive, and so I hold on to it with everything I've got.
Okay, so let's finish with this, right? The F word, because we're going to talk about that even more in our next segment. Forgiveness. And I want to correlate it with something that's just happened in the news recently, Carrie. Leslie Van Houten, she was among the Manson family members. She was one of the Manson family members. And she stabbed to death the wealthy grocer Lino LaBianca and his wife, Rosemary. And she was a teenager at the time, I think 19, something like that. She testified to knifing the woman in the back and in the buttocks 14 times with a bayonet and just smeared. She was the one that smeared the blood messages, right? So I don't want to get into the gross details of that, but I set that up on purpose to sort of say, well, now she's actually being recommended for parole. 50 years in prison, 22 attempts to be paroled. She was 19. She's now 69. How would you feel if that was your dad?
Well, I think there's a difference between forgiving somebody and letting somebody out of prison. Those two don't really go together. So we shouldn't let somebody like that out of prison, and we would never, ever let my dad out. Because if you're forgiving, when I say forgive my dad, I'm not forgiving him for the crimes, because those aren't mine to forgive. Those are the families. And even if the whole community forgave somebody, it's not like we want these people out on our streets. So I don't think forgiveness has anything to do with parole. So I would never let somebody like her or my father out.
Okay.
So I'm forgiving him for the betrayal and what he did to my family. And I needed to let it go because it was rotting in me and it was trying to kill me 7 years out. So God took that hardness from me so that I could come back to myself and move on. And if I had forgiven him, I wouldn't have been able to talk. I wouldn't have been able to write.
Man, there's so much behind your story. I find this so...
I know, and I was talking so long for you guys. I'm sorry. I was like...
No. What are you apologizing for? We're all sitting... The whole room is sitting here listening to you. This is... You're a captivating young woman with a captivating story, and then you throw into the mix the whole God stuff and forgiveness and moving on, and I mean, just what a read. So here's the book. Let me just finish with this. A Serial Killer's Daughter, My Story of Hope, Love, and Overcoming. And that's important. It's just not, oh, my dad did this, my dad did that. it really is your journey of hope and love and overcoming. So Carrie Rawson, daughter of the BTK killer, what a privilege to have you on our show, and I hope the nut jobs stay away.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Carrie. You take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You know, I think all of us put ourselves in situations like that and say, well, how would we respond? You imagine the FBI knocking your door, Tim, and saying...
No, because hey. I'm Canadian.
oh, thanks.
No, the police. Well, that's what I had said earlier in the show. We've got our own situation right now with Bruce MacArthur. Mm-hmm. And he has now confessed to murdering 8 people. And he has a wife and kids. Had a wife and kids, got divorced. And how does that impact them? Grandkids? Like, there's so many levels... Especially,
I already know I'm a walking disappointment to my children. But
well, we'll hear my parents' opinion on me later.
Yes,
so we'll
will.
Be okay.
Actually,
here.
Your parents told me that you were a great kid, except when you were 2. They called you Damien when you were 2.
I wouldn't be surprised.